Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, the wonderful little island-chained nation paradise, where we have container ships that split in half on our reefs and contaminate entire beaches with oil and crusting stuff like that, and we drop poison called 1080, which is illegal everywhere on Earth except New Zealand for outdoor use, into our pristine bush that kills absolutely everything. You know, it's clean, it's green, and it's free. Alright? And it's certainly not corrupt, according to Transparency's International Corruption Perception Index, which is, of course, called a perception index for a reason, because it's not the reality. My very special guest today is a, he should be quite a famous New Zealand reporter, and in certain circles, I guess he is. His name's Ben Vigen, and he's the creator of Postman Productions. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Vinny. How you doing? I don't know if I'm famous, but I'm certainly infamous. They recently did a thing where they turn around and they discovered that the New Zealand Defence Force describes investigative journalists as subversive. So there you are, I'm officially on the wanted list.
Well, you know, you can't, shall we say, go out telling the truth and what have you without having some kind of recompense if you're actually telling the truth, right? Some people go out there, Ben, and they say, I'm telling the truth, but it's actually all BS, you know, like John Key. And, of course, no consequences for telling lies, but there's plenty for telling the truth.
Well, there is, and it's also quite interesting because, you know, over the years, I've reported on various things, and at the time, my colleagues have turned around and said, you're a conspiracy theorist, that's all rubbish. And inevitably, within sort of around about anywhere from 6 months to 3 years, everything that I would report on does actually come to fruition. So it's quite interesting, the fact that I keep getting it right, and no one turns around and says, wait a minute, he got that right. Maybe we should listen to him this time. But, you know, that's, of course, because what I'm saying is against the status quo, and the status quo doesn't like to be shown up.
Well, wouldn't you say that part of the reason why these alleged credible journalists would criticise you and call you a conspiracy theorist and then not come out when you turn out to be right and say, hey, well, actually, you were right, is it's not because they're not saying or they don't think that you were correct, it's that they don't want to admit that they were wrong.
Yeah, well, that's highly likely the case. And, you know, down here in Dunedin, throughout the rest of New Zealand, we're facing an issue of drilling off the oil off New Zealand, which is, you know, one of those examples, because you can go back as far as 2003 with my second book, State Secrets 2, and I pointed out the fact that, you know, we had oil in the Southern Basin and this was going to be a major player in our geopolitics in the coming decade. At the time, people said, no, we don't, that's all rubbish now, that's just nonsense. And, of course, you know, now we've got oil survey ships left, right and centre. And no one seemed to answer, well, wait a minute, at a time when we were saying that there's no oil, he was saying that we do, maybe we should listen to him. And, you know, that's for obvious reasons, because the majority of the media in this country have their advertising from big business, and big business is connected to these larger groups that basically what I'm saying that people are listening to, we wouldn't have them here in the first place. Case in point, Anadarko Oil, if you go to the United States and you look at mainstream media, Wall Street Journal, CNN, they'll point out the fact that Anadarko, which is a company that we want to lead into, Otago, has been a reputable, great company, that this is a company that's actually currently facing up to a $40 million lawsuit for setting their firms up in such a way that if things do go wrong, they don't have to pay the damages. It hasn't been mentioned in not one single mainstream outlet today. And this is, you know, this is in New Zealand. All you have to do to find out that information is Google onto the mainstream in the US, but gosh darn it, our fingers of our journalists seem to be broken. They can't use Google.
Mm-hmm. Anadarko seems more like Anarko.
Yes, they do.
Maybe even just a little bit Unco, because they drilled a well that they didn't produce anything, didn't they?
Well, I mean, that's again another interesting point, because back in 77 we were drilling for oil with the Hunt brothers down here, and number one is, you know, they clapped up that well. We knew that there was oil there, and as, you know, events happening now show the fact that there is oil. They chose not to say it was empty because, of course, at the time they didn't want to share that wealth with other people and were hoping to get their stocks in order and come back, but, of course, they fell over. Anadarko right now potentially could be in exactly the same situation. You know, with that $14 billion, they're not getting a lot of investors into doing these sort of projects. So, you know, Taranaki's come to a halt. Raglan's come to a halt. They've just brought their ships back from Pegasus Bay. So you've got to question the fact of what's going on here, because, you know, they all went off with a hiss and a roar and everyone was rolling out the red carpet for them, and now they're sort of going, well, oh, they're finding ways not to do it. So, you know, my suggestion is we might actually win this one simply because Anadarko messed up in the United States and the roosters are coming home to bite them.
Well, one should hope. The question is, of course, does New Zealand play a much larger role in the international syndicate, the Anglo-American New World Order? Do we actually, as a country, hold any strategic significance for military operations in the South Pacific?
We hold massive amounts of strategic significance, and I'll just round you for five off the top of the head. First of all, New Zealand is based off the Pyramidic Trench, and this is a deep trench that runs from basically New Zealand to Hawaii. In the event of a nuclear war, what happens is the attack submarines come out of Pearl Harbor, they fire their missiles, they go to that trench, they rush down to New Zealand. So we're basically the gateway to what they call Submarine Alley. Of course, the other thing is, if you want to get the control of the mineral resources in Antarctica, there's basically four points in the southern hemisphere that you can jump from, which is sort of South Africa, New Zealand, Australia, and Chile. But New Zealand's the only place where you can run air-base operations for about 4 to 6 months of the year. So again, we're a gateway to Antarctica. We're right in the middle of South America and Australia. So again, if you look at the map of the world, we're a very strategic naval port. And of course, with the situation of climate warming, if you subscribe to that viewpoint, what would happen, of course, is that New Zealand, being a country that's surrounded by water, would be cooled down. It would be one of the few places in the world where you can effectively actually have a proper agricultural economy. So again, the strategic significance of this piece of real estate is increasingly becoming more and more important. And that's something which I managed to put to the then Minister of Science and Technology, that Labor government, just told me, Peter Hodgkins, and, you know, Peter Hodgkins said, well, actually, I think you've got a point there. So, you know, it's not just my viewpoint. The Chief Minister of the Science and Technology saw my logic and agreed with me.
If that's the case, then, if we hold such strategic significance, it would occur to me that international agendas would be at play to more or less take control of this country, usually by economic means, first of all, and then once you've controlled the entire country's economy, you no longer have to worry about who's in charge.
Well, that's what the OPAL file, which is you just can Google the OPAL file, Aotearoa, New Zealand, very old document, it's been around since the 1980s. One of the things that Richard said, there was oil, and everyone laughed at it, but today if you pick up a piece of document, you go through it, which is what I've done, and I've used archive methods, the newspapers, declassified material, most of that document can verify, which basically says, you know, back as far as 1975, they saw the strategic importance of New Zealand, and they've been moving their guys and taking up key positions ever since. And of course, you know, fitting with naval doctrine as well. The United States Pentagon's own press release to say that, you know, by 2020 they want to have 6% of the U.S. naval fleet stationed in the South Pacific. So again, in that context, our significance becomes increasingly important.
So how exactly are they planning to economically take us over then, if that is the case? We have oil drillings and all of that coming in. I was speaking to a friend of mine a couple of weeks ago, Ben, and he was working in Vietnam during the mid to late 90s, and he was doing a bit of consulting and talked to a Chinese diplomat who he believed to be really corrupt. And that Chinese diplomat told him that New Zealand is one of the major targets for China. And he claimed or alleged that China was getting a lot of its quote-unquote undesirables, you know, people who might go to camps or be executed and what have you, shoving a quarter of a million or $1 million in their pocket, clearing their records, sending them to New Zealand so that they can buy up homes and businesses. And the hope was, at least according to this diplomat, that eventually New Zealand would wind up being owned by China.
Well, you're throwing a lot of stuff in there, but I'll try and follow. First of all, if you look at the Australian Defence White Papers, the terminology they refer to in terms of New Zealand is that we're basically a frontline territory for, quote unquote, the coming war with China. So even the Australian diplomats, you know, support that that belief system. As far as the immigrant situation goes, well, they're actually doing it sort of a number of places: New Zealand, Australia, Canada. But you know, it's funny you should mention Vietnam, because we had our office there that dealt with immigration, and the guys that were actually doing it were a company called Vostok Services. They were operating out of the New Zealand consulate in Vietnam. The guys, Ian Robinson, also owned a bank in Auckland called Proc Bank, which was actually co-run by the Russian mafia. Most of the cohorts he was working with in Vietnam were with Russian mafia. And of course, that same company, which they also were involved with the MILF deal, the Food for Oil program. And you know, this is a dodgy Russian company that's helping handling our immigration issues. And of course, if you look back at virtually every single immigration minister that we've had in the last 15 years, you know, there is a strong case in every single one of them to link them to organised crime. My first book, State Secrets, actually, in fact, you know, does that, goes through effectively every single one we had up until, I think it was John Tummy. No, I can't remember. Philip, anyway, the last Labour-based Minister of Immigration, I have, you know, a fairly list of all of them in there. And, you know, basically what they've done is, step one, to go back to what you're saying, is they've moved into New Zealand, they've bought up key positions or influence within both political parties and major corporations and now councils and university infrastructures. Step two, that they turn around and they wage the war. There's a book called The Rise and Fall of Brierley's Investment, which, for your American listeners, this was a major New Zealand corporation. What they did was they lured Brierley's overseas. They had them invest with all this cash stocks into fairly dubious investments. In 95, Arms Risk Management, which was another Australian firm linked to another guy from the Australian in the Food for Oil, that collapsed. That set off the collapse of banks. All those investments were sucked up, and Brierley's investment went from being a company that was cash rich to suddenly it was heavily in debt. And effectively what they did was they lured these companies into debt, and then they just took them actually over. So that was the second stage. And if you follow that progression through, you've got companies like South Canterbury Finance can be seen having fallen to the same trap. And in my book, State Secrets 2, in 2006, I went into South Canterbury Finance's headquarters in Christchurch by the Bridge of Remembrance. I took a photograph of the foyer of the building. I went through all the companies in that building. I listed the company records, who the directors were, and then I vetted them in terms of, you know, were they in the newspapers for embezzlement, arms running, connections to the spy industry. The whole building was absolutely raft full of corrupt figures. So, you know, by 2006, I was pointing the finger at this company saying, it's dodgy. Everyone's going, no, South Canterbury Finance is such a nice company. It's run by such a nice gentleman. No, you're mistaken. And of course, then they turn around and they fell over. Step three is the trickier part, which is when we start getting into the issues such as the earthquakes, which, as you know, I've campaigned quite strenuously to point out the fact there's a lot of signatures that the device HAARP was used before the first and second earthquakes. The most significant issue about all of that is that one of the things I pointed out was during that the first and second earthquakes. Are you there? Are you there?
Yeah.
Just having a bit of interconnection problem last year, but okay. During the first and second earthquake, I pointed out that one of the symptoms of there being a strong electromagnetic influence in the atmosphere was a series of fireballs. For example, on the Boxing Day in the Christchurch Press of that day, there was a fireball on the front page. I was actually on Facebook saying, hey guys, you know, when you add all the other factors that are involved, and when you look at this, looks like we could be in for another earthquake. Bang, that afternoon we got hit. I did that again recently. We just had the stranding of a whole bunch of whales here up in the top end of the southern hemisphere. The top part of South Island, in conjunction with the earthquake lights that were roaming up and down the countryside and that have now only just been acknowledged by the media as existing. 2 years ago, they said, no, that's not true. Now they're saying, actually, I'm right that earthquake lights do exist. This recent earthquake in Wellington, day beforehand, we had whales washing up, we had these lights striking. I even turned around and said, this will actually happen in the North Island. Bang. Happen again. So far my call rate on that's been about 4 to 5, or 80% of the time I've turned around and said, look, all these factors point to me that there's our atmosphere is charged, and wham, next couple of days it happens. So, you know, what they've done is they've attacked our infrastructure, they've again moved their people into this, they've used it to change legislation. They're putting the pieces in quite nicely. And I know for a lot of people that's fringe, so be it. I go back to all my other cases that I've reported on and said, look, I was right about this. I can show you from 1993 when I've been reporting on this, all the background science, case histories behind HAARP, the fact that I called it with the Indonesian earthquake, I've called it with New Zealand earthquakes. You know, after a while, when you start seeing the same person on the same logistics, the same hardware, you kind of start to think this is a little bit more than a coincidence.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're not supposed to believe in coincidence, are you?
And of course, you know, the last one, which unfortunately I haven't had a chance to run through my entire checklist, but we've just actually had 9 orca whales stranded up on Southland as well. So it will be interesting from that viewpoint to sort of go online to things like the Meteorological Service, see that we're having reports of these sonic booms and aurora borealis activity in the sky, to see if there are any cases of light aircraft suddenly falling out of the sky, to see what other personnel or hardware are in place at that time. One of my lives, I used to be what they call an artillery intelligence operator, and the laws remain the same. Whether a pea shooter or an atom bomb, any weapon has a forensic signature. When you see the same signatures occurring, and you trace them back to the same point, and you see the same personnel, and you see the same money trail, then that's when you write a note to the boss and say, this is the kind of cannon I think they're using. And this is basically what I'm doing. I'm using the same methodology I was trained in the Army with HAARP, and basically... you know, my results are speaking for themselves.
Mm. So,
can I just interject? You know, it's a really tricky one for me because HAARP is not a subject that wins you any friends, and certainly a lot of people in the mainstream media think, well, you're tinfoil conspiracy stuff when you say this. So, I do this knowing that this is not going to get me an award, or I'm not going to be driving a Ferrari, but I do it because my conscience won't allow me to do it otherwise.
Yeah, I think it's actually a very similar reason to what I was doing. And one of my listeners asked me, you know, Vinny, why do you keep doing this? You know, why do you keep putting yourself through it? And I go, well, you know, as far as I'm concerned, we may not win, you know, that's basically, you know, I'm kind of resigned to failure, but I'm going to keep doing it anyway, not because I think that there's a victory capable of happening for me or whatever, but just because it's the right thing to do. Now, we may achieve victory, we may wind up exposing all of the scumbaggery and people will stop listening to lies and BS and what have you, but I'm not going to hold my breath.
The probability is that we are not going to win in yours or my lifetime, and this is the thing, is that this is a war. We are in a battle right now. This battle is stacked heavily against us, and the chances are we are not going to win this battle. But hopefully by keeping that flame alive and by providing information to the next generation, we give them the tools to dig deep. We're in a similar situation, I guess, to 1938 France, where we're the ones actually being the canaries in the cage. We will be the ones that get rounded up and taken out the back shot, while others get the chance to use that information to prepare themselves. And those are the ones that you don't hear about. They are out there. They're doing lots of good work, but their time is yet to come.
Mm. It comes onto a point of moral obligation, I think. Now, when we talk about this country, New Zealand's actually quite significant, as we've pointed out, in terms of strategically speaking. We're also untapped resources. We've got quite a lot of those, don't we?
We do have a lot of those resources, and again, it's an interesting situation because if you go back as far as 1905, I used to have a book in my position called Oil Fields in New Zealand, H.D. Reid. It was the official Crown survey of New Zealand's oil potential. The opening sentence of that book said that we have more oil than the whole Commonwealth combined. Pre-World War I, the whole issue of New Zealand oil resources came available. Became a topic. It didn't get developed because World War I saw the capture of territories in the Middle East, which meant that they didn't need to harvest these areas. The same thing happened in World War II. 1970, we had the issue came up. OPEC came through. And this is an interesting one, too, that a lot of people don't know. When the Hunt brothers were developing oil down here, our government turned around and asked for 25% royalties, which is pretty much unheard of. But at the same time they were doing that, Adnan Khashoggi, a very famous figure who acts as the spokesman for the OPEC oil cartel, who at that stage were trying to create a monopoly in conjunction with Standard Oil and the big boys to control the oil markets. He came to our Prime Minister. He said, look, here's the deal. If you leave your oil in the ground and change your investment law so that we can start buying up your territory, we will open our markets to you in the Middle East. Now, at that point, our entire exports from New Zealand to the entire continent of the Middle East were less than $4 million New Zealand dollars. By 1980 alone, we were exporting more than $400 million to Iran. And the bridging finance of all the what we call in New Zealand the Think Big projects, which were designed to make us an industrial country, but that's actually just put us into debt, that all came through Adnan Khashoggi's bank. Again, this is in the open files, and it's only now, in the last 2 years, that information is now verifiable via public sources. And in my case, my secondary source, that was actually Richard White on Radio New Zealand, confirmed my assumptions about Khashoggi being the bridging for Think Big were correct.
Well, what's the significance precisely? I mean, that's something that's going on. Do they have further plans, and what's the end game on that?
Well, again, it's interesting when you look at the players at the time. Like in 1977, what we did was we were like most countries. We had a 12-mile limit in terms of all the resources in that area was what we could mine, fish, etc. At that time, our farmers, you could sell milk to whoever they like. They could sell it at the gate. Our fisher guys could sell it to people driving past on the road. They had little caravans started up inside the coastline. Well, when we turned around and we said, look, we'll go for steel, we brought them what we or the economic exclusion zone, which then meant that 200 miles of territory we were claiming, the only way we could get this through at the United Nations is with the support of China, Russia, and most of the major players, with the exception of the US, on condition to us also bringing what we call the Economic Exclusion Act, which basically meant that these companies could now come into New Zealand and do joint ventures with us. Now, one of the main steps at the same time was Sir Douglas Goodwin, who founded what they called Amalgamated Dairies and Sanford Fisheries, he got involved. He basically set the ball rolling. Well, you look what happened to Amalgamated Dairies. Amalgamated Dairies became the New Zealand Dairy Board, which was basically a loose co-op. New Zealand Dairy Board became Fonterra, which became a full-on monopoly. So today, you can't buy milk off a farmer. You have to go to Fonterra. They set the price. We've got massive amounts of cows in New Zealand, but New Zealand, it's cheaper for a farmer to go and buy Coca-Cola than it is for him to buy milk in his own dairy. Interesting thing, too, is that the term amalgamated dairies was a term that Lenin himself used, and it was used to divide the method by which bourgeois farmers would be pushed off their farms and forced into a state collective via the creation of a debt cycle. And this is exactly what happened with the dairy farmers in New Zealand. I've always found this quite funny because, again, another one of my lives was I used to work as a researcher for Westpac in Australia. We got given a magazine at one stage in the early 90s, and it was called Globalism for Bankers, and it had a picture of Lenin's head being dismantled and basically described globalism or what we call free trade associated with the TTTPA or Trans-Tasman Pacific Agreement. It described globalism as a free trade where it was all about capitalism. But to make this happen, you had to have a fair and level playing field, which would be centralized and overseen by these wise guys that would be made up of bankers, academics, and industrialists. Well, I burst out laughing when I read this because my degree is in political science, and if I had to write an essay on what was the difference between Marx and Lenin, I would say, well, basically, Marx never defined who the Central Committee should be made up of. He just sort of loosely defined it as kind of a benevolent cross between the Easter Bunny, the Tooth Fairy, and Father Christmas. It was Lenin who turned around and defined that the Central Committee of the Politburo should be basically made up of these people that are backed by bankers, industrialists, and academics. In other words, the very formula for what we associate globalism or what we call super capitalism today. So left wing, right wing, the same turkey. You know, we use these words, but they really at the end of the day boil down to the few controlling the many.
Yeah, it's like atheism and Bible bashing. You'll notice that some people will go from hardcore Bible basher, never will listen to anybody about anything, you know, that kind of thing. The Bible's everything there is to know. And then they have some kind of an awakening, and then they become a full-on atheist, and they never listen to anybody or anything because they think they know everything and that science is their God. And then they'll have an awakening at that point in some point as well, and then they'll become a hardcore Satanist. And then they'll never listen to anybody because nothing else. You see what I'm saying? And that's the way they
can't. Their methodology never changes.
It's the way that they capture people by providing these little outlets, more or less, politically speaking. And if you can do that, if you can manipulate people effectively enough through the use of propaganda and sophisticated mind control like public school, you can wind up actually having a massive quantity of control over everybody by controlling both of these sides of the arguments that they'll gravitate towards as soon as one side of the argument disillusions them.
It's basically what you're dealing with. It's a divide and conquer methodology. And, you know, if you look at this model in terms of a macro model in terms of global affairs, or you want to look at it from a micro level in terms of looking at council politics, it's the same methodology. You know, I'll bring it back to my local bit of the world. Here in Dunedin, we have the issue of two camps. We have the pro-oil camp, or as they like to call themselves, the pro-gas camp, and we have the Otago Oil Free camp. Now, these are two people that are arguing, and that this creates a division within the community. While this division is going on, what they're not actually looking at is the fact that, you know, this pro-gas camp, this issue is actually being peddled by central government. And while central government's turning around and saying, hey, guys, you've got to have oil, and this is really going to be good for your economy, they're actually doing things like they're shutting down our engineering factories here in Dunedin. They're shutting down our science research facility, Invermay. That's 85 jobs, $100 million a year for Dunedin, which is a college town, so it's a big deal. And all the way, what they're doing is they're shutting these things down and centralizing it. So while we argue over oil and gas and we're a diverse community, we're not pushing forward what we need to, the government's stepping in and just closing down things and creating the game so that wealth centralizes into them. The same thing that's happening to government here, to the local government, is now happening to our New Zealand. We get divided between this Labour, National arguments, and we argue over these fairly trivial issues while we ignore the fact that basically the power within us has been centralized into global bodies such as the Trans-Tasman, you know, Tasman Pacific Agreement.
TPPA.
I hate that word.
Trans-Pacific.
It's mostly loaded. Yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking more like it's a the way I remember TPPA is it's a toilet paper public address.
Yeah.
All right.
And you know, so all these things are actually going on, which, you know, it's centralization of the power. And at the end of the day, like, I don't like using the word Illuminati, New World Order. Again, I find them very emotionally loaded terms. But the reality is, if you boil it down to basic statistics, in 1980, loosely, the world's resources were concentrated in the hands of 90% of the world's population. 90% of the world's resource was in the hands of 10%. By September 11th, we were looking at basically 95% of the world's wealth in the hands of 5%. We're now looking at that figure. It's growing to 99% in the hands of 1%. So whatever wording you want to use, the reality is that wealth is going to become into a more centralized source of people. You know, every year it becomes the few having more, and basically passing on conditions to us, which basically make us slaves on our own planet.
Have you ever seen somebody play a poker game where they've got the small stack of chips and somebody else has an enormous stack of chips, and you know for a fact that it's not possible for that person with the small amount of chips to compete because he's just going to be outbid and destroyed? Yeah?
Yeah, that's us.
Yeah.
And it's a really, I mean, I guess when you're faced with those situations, you have to go into part of yourself, which for me is, you know, I'm a very left-brain guy, I'm not very much into spiritualism, but the reality is when you realize that, you've also got to take into account that we are just one speck in this great huge cosmos. And, you know, what happens in 10 years or 100 years on this planet really isn't that much in the greater scheme. So at the moment, those guys have got all the chips. We've got few chips. It's probably that we're going to lose the next few hands because that's just basic maths. But the reality is, these guys also, if you look across the history, they are the most self-destructive body that ever comes about, and they always sink their own game. You know, even when they're winning, they somehow manage to mess it up for themselves. And I think, you know, we're just going to hold the line, be true to ourselves, and, you know, that's what inevitably will actually happen. And the world is a cycle. You've seen it happen millions of times where huge empires have come about and then they've just collapsed. And that's it. They get too top-heavy and they just fall over.
Well, and here's the question, though. Do those collapsing societies only collapse on the public face so that the people who are running it from behind the scenes can make off with all the wealth and then start up another one?
I think there's a very strong argument to be made for that. And it's, don't even, you know, worry about this particular current global collapse. You can go all the way back to pre-World War II or the Great Depression. I think it was Stock Question of 1928. Again, there's plenty of resources available now to also our universities that show pretty much all that the main players knew beforehand and were actually pulling the resources out of the market. I can't remember which particular magnate it was, but he turned around with the quote, as he says one day, I was having my shoes polished and the shoe boys started to give me stocks. It was at that point that I knew it was time to get out of the market. These guys have access to a huge amount of resources. They always know where the game's going. And if you talk about things like, you know, the Federal Reserve, the Federal Reserve is a private body, and it's a revolving chair. So the same people in companies like Goldman and Sachs also work in the Federal Chair. They're not going to sink their own pals. You know, they're not going to sink their golf buddies. They're going to turn around, warn them in advance, allow them to act accordingly. The bailout turns out happens. What happens? Does the government turn around and take away a whole bunch of people and arrest them for, you know, dodgy dealings? No, it gives them bonuses and it lets them to keep trading. It's us that get penalised for their mistakes.
And occasionally they throw out like one kind of person or whatever and just go, see, this is the guy that's done all the bad stuff. Yeah. Throw him in jail and everything will be solved. And of course, everything just gets way significantly worse because often the person that they threw out was somebody who was trying to change the system for the better.
I think, you know, I sort of slightly change subjects on you a bit, but, you know, it's been going around my head a wee bit for a while. It's like, to be honest, I don't really care to do much of a rat's ass what the human race do. We're creatures of our own. We made this step, and we sat back and chose not to do anything. What annoys me is that we share this planet with over 22 million other species that have every right to have an existence, and we are messing it up for them. And there are lots, even if we survive, and I really do believe the human race is resourceful and we will get through this, but in doing so, we will be guilty of, I don't even know what the word for us beyond genocide, but we will be guilty for wiping out so many fellow sentient beings. And, you know, it really just breaks my heart when I think about it. And it's, you know, I'm a left-brain person, I deal on land-based issues, but, you know, I turn around and see these orcas that are washed up today, and I look at the fact that there's, in New Zealand, a country that prides itself being on clean and green. You know, within 30 years, we've gone from ponds that are hundreds are large to now they're down to tens. And within my lifetime, these species will be gone. And that's as a result of, directly as a result of these guys' psychopathic greed.
Mm. You do have a great point there, and I think the word you're looking for is extermination, right? And
global extermination.
Yeah, and it's kind of like in War of the Worlds when they say this is no more of a war than there is a war between men and maggots. And it occurs to me that it's not necessarily the human race's fault that we haven't done anything, because we've had a system that's been set up to us by people who are very, very well versed at manipulation, who are far more resourceful than people give them credit for sometimes, who have figured out a way to educate people so that anything that's real appears insane, and anything that's totally insane appears perfectly reasonable. And suspicion is looked upon as insanity. Being spiritual is looked upon as a weakness, and all of these sort of things. It's basically the only way they've managed to turn the world into the exact opposite of what it really should be is to teach everybody the exact opposite way that things should be and make them believe it.
Exactly. One of my most favorite and sacred books of all is a book by an author called Arthur Kessler, and it's called The Call Girls. I cannot stress it enough for anybody out there. You know, what everything you said is in this book, and he wrote this book in the early 70s. He highlighted these think tanks that the elite rate and how how much they plan in advance, the details of which they go about, their methodologies. It's a little book. It's less than 100 pages. It makes an excellent read. But you know, everything in that book was based on true facts, and he makes that point very clearly in the beginning of the book. You know, you can go back to Orson Welles. There's so many writers and filmmakers in the 1950s that were telling us this right back at the end of World War II, when you had all these symposiums being held to look at the issues of global population growth, resource shrinking. You know, these guys back in the 1950s were spending money studying it, researching, discussing it, putting their plans in actions, while most of the world had no idea that any of this was going on. Today, circa 50 years later, we get a few people that start to form little symposiums that, you know, dig into their pockets for pocket money. They aren't trained in methodology. They don't have the fuller picture. You know, it's like watching ants compete against an elephant.
You do have a point there, and what I've found interesting about your analogy, though, is that if enough ants crawled over an elephant, they'd not only drive it mad, but they'd eventually get it killed.
And you have hit the nail on the money. And I've given you all the doom and gloom, so now it's time to give you guys the positive spin. Yes, about last week I had the privilege of interviewing a guy called Andrew McMaguana, M-W-A-N-G-U-R-A. They call him the Pirate Whisperer. He is the founder of an organization called the East African Seafarers Association. Now, this is a man that is highly educated, that has worked in over 47 countries in the world. He chose to go back to Kenya, where he lives in a hut that has no electricity. His entire operation began with a cell phone. To this day, if you want to turn around and find out anything that's happening in the area in relation to maritime matters from Johannesburg to Dubai, this is the man you come to. And this is, you know, you've got Hollywood, you've got reporters, you've got spies, you've got diplomats, you've got gunrunners, you've got everyone when it comes to this guy, because he's the ultimate clearing guy. What this guy does is he does not judge anybody. He simply gets information and passes it along, and the power which he has in unifying and creating resources for the ship workers and the maritime workers of Kenya is just phenomenal. By not pointing the finger at anybody, he never points the finger at anybody. He is the ultimate negotiator. He always goes, what is our common ground? How can we find common ground? And from this, take all the ants and build them so that they are one. I rank this man as, I mean, this guy has changed my life. And I rate this man right up there with Nelson Mandela. And there's a very good reason why Samuel Jackson's about to make a movie on this guy's life. Now, the point I'm making is he's living proof that one person can make a difference. And the Kenyan government had gone after this guy time and time again. But because of his position and his ability to build bridges and find common grounds, he is protected. And this guy sets a systematic, a role model for all of us to do. We need to go out there, connect, find people, not on Facebook. I mean in your communities, I mean in your country. Find people that are doing clever things without ego, with humility, and work together. Because you're right, Vinny, we outnumber these guys 1,000 to 1. And once we start to realize that, these guys stay outnumbered. So, yeah, they're going to win a few poker games, but this game is by far not over.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when you are taking out a target, it's best to aim at the right target. You know what I'm saying? And yeah. I think people have gotten overtly obsessed with the symptoms of the New World Order rather than the individuals who are putting it into place. Like, for example, I'm just going to come out and say I hate and fear police, especially the New Zealand police, namely because they hurt you for no good reason. They arrest you unlawfully and kill people and get away with it.
I had the most fantastic police experience this New Year's Eve. I got arrested on New Year's Eve. Would you like to know what I got arrested for?
Having an elevated mood level?
I got arrested for reporting a crime. And I've never, quite frankly, had so much fun in all my life. I won't go into full details, but basically we entered into a bar. My friend had her handbag stolen. I tried to basically get assistance from the manager and the security. When that didn't work, I tried to approach a police officer. New Year's Eve, a whole octagon full of drunken adults, and the police officer was choosing to concentrate on the four kids at the top of the octagon that were doing nothing but watching the adults make idiots of themselves. I tried to say, look, you know, I need your assistance. There's something happening right now. We can get these guys. The guy wouldn't listen. In the end, he basically said, if you don't go away, I'm going to arrest you. And I said, what, for reporting a crime? You're under arrest. Turned around, let him put his hands, you know, I cooperated the whole way through, let him put my hands behind my back, cuffed me, made sure it was double tight, slammed me against the paddy wagon, took me downtown, got out of the paddy wagon. I said, okay, guys, I've never been arrested before. You know, I don't want to cause you. I want to make your night smooth as possible. You know, tell me what the protocol is, and I'll just go along with you. So I spent the entire evening, well, about an hour and a half, basically cooperating with them. But at the same time, I was also doing, you know, I was cooperating with them, but I was also basically making them aware that they didn't have the power. And, for example, at one stage when the guy was writing stuff down, his hand was starting to shake because he was starting to realize that he wasn't quite dealing with the normal character. And he turned around and said, what do you do for an occupation? And I said, in a deadpan voice, I'm a journalist. You should have seen his pen. It just like shot off the paper. And I said, what's the matter, mate? Have you got Parkinson's disease? Your hand's shaking. And his friend turned around to me, or his partner turned around to me and said, you know, you don't know when to leave it alone, do you? And I said, look, at the end of the day, I'm cooperating. I'm more than happy to see how this rolls out in a court case. I'm fully aware of what I have and haven't done. And, you know, I'll let the chips fall where they are. This is not South Africa. I am not Stephen Biko. So at this end of the day, yeah, I'm going to turn around and call you guys out because you've messed up. Meanwhile, while this was going on, the desk sergeant upstairs was starting to piece things together because it turned out that I wasn't the only person who had their bag stolen. Within half an hour, they were dealing with about 5 cell phones that had been stolen. So, you know, I'm dealing with this police officer, and there's an ever-increasing rank of police officers coming through that have got – the first one had one stripe on his shoulder, and the next one had 2 stripes on the shoulder, and the third one had pips on the shoulder, and they're all looking at my paperwork. And basically, then the chairman and said, look, you know, we made a mistake. We're dreadfully sorry about this. Have a good night and let me go. But it all
happened. A mistake, my ass.
His next word was, thank you. He rang me up half an hour later and said, thank you for being a good sport about it. And the point I'm making, Ben, is that I didn't lose my cool. I knew that at the end of the day, like, you know, the cops tend to forget. They think they're the only badge in town. Well, I've got a press badge and I know how to use it, you know. And at the end of the day, I kept my cool. I didn't give them any grievance to up the ante. I knew the system well enough. And at the end of the day, they backed off because they were outgunned and they knew it.
But did the officer who arrested you and, I think, kidnapped you and assaulted you, I think would be the technical terms here, did he receive any of any kind, I mean, discipline?
No, of course he didn't. You know, and
so you didn't win. You didn't win. Well, you just didn't get locked up. You just didn't get locked up for life for nothing.
Well, actually, no, Vinny, I did win on a number of levels. Was number one, I managed to get a point through to him. I said to him, "Look, you've got to understand that when you deal with people, because I was with my partner, she was in a state of agitation. So when you deal with people, you've got to realize that people have experiences before they encounter you, and if you're under stress, they're likely to act in post-traumatic, you know, in a traumatic, which means they're not giving you the best. You've got to take that on board." And he turned around to me and said, "You're right. You know, I've actually," and basically, all the three primary police officers I was dealing with that night, they walked away, basically congratulating me for what I was doing. And I felt that I won friends that night. So, you know, the cops are not our enemy. They're just people that need to be re-educated. And at the end of the day, when the stock market crashes and these guys lose their pension, they're the ones that we need to get on our side because they're the ones that know the system.
Actually, my point was, when we started off on this whole thing, and I'm very sorry that it happened here, was that all they are is the front line. Okay, they're the cards. They're the backs of the cards. You don't know what's behind the cards. You don't know what kind of hand they're holding and what have you. There's a player holding all of those cards, okay? I'm not saying go after the frickin' jacks and the kings and the aces. Go after the person who's holding the whole frickin' deck, the whole stacked deck. Now, if we're talking about corruption, and this is kind of what's happening in this country at, in my opinion, an alarming rate, is an enormous increase in the incidence of corruption, not only in private companies and what have you, but also in the public sphere as well. We've got this.
Oh, look, it's.
Go ahead.
It's systematic throughout the system. And to give you another localized example, we have just had a series of dramas occur within our hospitality bar scene, which has emerged that gangs are behind this, which is a very, you know, Dunedin is a little rural town. It's if you imagine the United States, it's like somewhere out of New England. It's like, it's so goody two shoes on the surface, you wouldn't believe it. It's only when you start peeling behind, you realize it's the Stephen King novel. But, you know, we started to have these gang scenes occur, which is very new for us. And then the next thing you know, we start to get the arrival of a gang called the Bandidos, which is an international criminal fraternity organisation. They've arrived. I knew about this 2 weeks before it appeared in the Otago Daily Times. And the report that appeared in the Otago Daily Times was, this major super gang is coming to town. But don't worry about it, because gangs only hurt gangs. Nothing to fear. Move along. Now, within 15 metres of me is our octagon. It's the town centre. Over the last 3 weeks, me and many other people in my same community have sat back and we have watched these guys come in. They pull up in their $60,000 sports cars, their $75,000 Harley Davidsons. They're there every second day. You can see them riding up and down the town with patches. They're moving in. They're coming here to basically bring methamphetamine into this town, which has not managed to establish itself. And our system so far is sitting back and going, don't worry about it. You know, that's how corrupt it is. They don't even want to fight these guys. And these guys can stick a flag right in the middle of our octagon, because that's what they're doing, where they stick their Harley Davidsons there and they ride around the patches and they sit there drinking their beers, and we won't lift a finger. It takes guys like me to embarrass our police, to embarrass my fellow colleagues in the media before people start to do it. And this is what I do. This is where I come into play. I put footballs on the play field and I put them in a position where they say, you either act now, or else this goes on your record that you were warned and I did it in a very, very public way and you chose not to do anything. And there's nothing these guys fear more than embarrassment, and that is my strongest weapon against them. Their embarrassment and their fear of failure.
Well, they actually fear being exposed less than only one other thing. Even worse psychopaths than them.
Yep.
They follow even less rules.
Well, at the end of the day, they are more, they are afraid of these guys. And you know, at a localised level, I've sat there and I've watched police officers, big, you know, senior players of the gang movement come down here, get pulled over, police officers go to put their handcuffs, and then the big guys just literally shake their hands off. Police do this the second time, and the third time the police guys get back in the cars and drive off. It's just amazing. You know, and here I am, you know, like basically my paper will come out in about a week's time, and I've turned around and I've loaded a direct shotgun at the Bandidos and made it very clear in public what's going to happen. Now, you know, part of me should be scared shitless, and I actually am. But at the end of the day, the best defence you've got against those thugs is they are scum. They like to hide under rocks, and when they don't want to be dragged out to public. And in a way, I'm goading them. I want them to do something, because if they do, that's it. But then I force the other hands to take action.
Have you investigated possible connections between senior police and or council officials to the Bandido gang?
Well, on a local level, that's a subject which, I'll put it this way, right now I would rather not go there, because I simply haven't carried out the investigation at a local level, because this is very new. But if you want to take it from a wider scale, my first book, State Secrets, it goes fully into the whole connection between political government and organised crime. More frequently, we turn around, because the Bandidos, while they're doing this in Dunedin, they're also doing it in our second major city in the South Island, Christchurch. In Christchurch, the feedback that I'm getting continuously from my sources up there is that it's not just the gangs that are involved in this, they are working alongside the police. And this is no surprise to me, because again, I reported this back in my first book in 1919, State Secrets. I was told that there was no organised crime in New Zealand. In 2000, the New Zealand police released their first organised crime report, which identified over 375 criminal syndicates operating within New Zealand. Since that time, we have had several major senior police officers actually go down for drugs, criminal organised. So what I was told in 1999 was, oh no, that's rubbish, that doesn't happen in little old New Zealand, land of the hobbits. Now we take for granted it's actually, you know, even the police report on organised crime said these guys have infiltrated into every single branch of government that exists in New Zealand. And, you know, on top of that, if you flip that through to the US model, we make a comparison, this is not just about gangs and government. But, you know, in the United States, if you look at the methamphetamine trade, you have a situation where the major component that went into this meth was a cough mixture. In the United States, the law was changed so that basically those medicines or those components couldn't be made. Well, the firms, major firms, which were mostly Chinese-based or China-owned based in India, continued to make those pills. They were simply shipped out to Mexico, so that all along the Mexican border, the little pharmacy town, suddenly they went from being one pharmacy to having 400 pharmacies. The locals were shilling this meth, making, you know, the components which made meth. Those meths were being shipped into the United States, where they became a drain on the resources. Meanwhile, 90% of the weapons that were used or bought by the meth gangs in Mexico were made in China. So what does that tell you about the geopolitics of drugs?
Well, what about Fast and Furious, where Barack Obama signed off an operation to give Mexican drug cartels copious quantities of weapons, and then those weapons got found out to be in the United States, in the possession of the Mexican drug cartels, shooting U.S. police officers and towns?
Well, you're completely correct. And the thing is also, if for those who are familiar with the Iran-Contra and Bush politics, if you actually look at the rings that were used to smuggle weapons into the Nicaraguan-Contras back in the 80s, what you're seeing is a reemergence of those same rings. And, of course, the most famous one is the case where they formed a unit called CENTAC, which, don't ask me the alphabet, but this was a task force designed to go after the very top players. They had more than 90% of major convictions came from this task force, which had a very small budget. Well, under Bush, they shut this unit down. But in the records of CENTAC, it turned out that one of their officers got arrested. Well, Oliver North turns around and writes it up in his biography as that this guy was a bad guy, and he got, you know, basically his version was totally fabricated. It's only when we had the Iran-Contra and they reached him and they grabbed his emails that you realize actually they just made it up. They turned the good guys into the bad guys and the bad guys into the good guys. But that route back in the 80s is what we're now seeing happening now, and it's reflected in pop culture and things like Sons of Anarchy. You know, that Sons of Anarchy is a brilliant television series because it demonstrates you exactly the politics of US and New Zealand. The same thing that happens in America is happening here, and it's not new. It happened with Mr. Asia back in the 70s in New Zealand.
Now, can we say that this is not a reemergence, that theoretically it's been going on the whole time and only once in a while does it get exposed, that these types of things are not the exception, they're the rule?
Business as usual, baby. And, you know, again, if you study your politics or your history and you go back to the Opium Wars, which is, you know, companies like, well, you know, Jardines and a lot of these families, which, you know, people that are into the whole Illuminati history will be very familiar with. I just say, you know, families of influence, because that's the language I'm more comfortable with. This is the same tactics that they were using. They used on China and to take Hong Kong, and it's just repeated itself. And it's just, you know, it's a formula that works, so they continue using it. And at the end of the day, mm-hmm. there's a lot of money to be made in prohibition.
Well, if there's money involved and power involved, you have to assume that scumbaggery is involved.
There is scumbaggery involved at the highest levels. And again, this is the comment that was made in the CENTAC was, you know, the paraphrase, you said, you know, you don't have to be a CIA hater to be suspicious that every time you go to the State Department requesting handcuffs that you find guys in dark sunglasses dealing with the same bureaucrats offering them roses. And guess which ones win? You know, a lot of these guys, and this is fairly true in New Zealand as well, a lot of your major informants are actually the top players of the drug world, and what they're simply doing is they're using their status as informant to shut down their competition.
That's absolutely true, and not only that, but it works both ways. I heard an allegation that the New Zealand police will raid certain gangs on the say-so of their informant, and then they will steal that gang's drugs and then sell it to the informant in exchange for a favour of some description, for example, a contract killing. Have you heard anything like that?
Well, there's three particular points here, or three people I'd like to mention. Two of which I'll name and one of which I won't. When I was involved in the territorials, which is the American equivalent of the National Reserves, one of my postings was I worked in counterintelligence, and my commanding officer was Wendy Heath, who at that time was also an officer in the New Zealand Police. She was a CIB officer. Well, she, along with a friend and a colleague of mine, Pat O'Brien, who today is a journalist, they turned around and they broke ranks along with, in fact, a third police officer who's also a colleague of mine, Peter Williams, and they broke ranks and they said, you know, we perjured our asses off. You know, we lied and we smoked drugs and we did all this bits and pieces, and because we were told to do so. Fast forwarding, like, you know, in terms of people being hired to do contract killings, I've heard this on numerous bases, and the third person I was going to mention beforehand who is completely linked into the bar, to some of these businesses and bars that are the banditos are turned up in town. Well, this guy's job in the police was involved with the part that dealt with the gangs. Now, I had a third source come up to me one day and said, you know what that guy said to me? And I said, what? He said, look, you know how I've got that alteration with that other guy that's ripped me off? And I said, yeah, yeah. He said, well, he turned around and said, you know, why don't you go to court with this guy? Because we'll make sure he goes to jail and we'll send him to a Road Knight gang, which is one of our major gangs down here, and we'll make sure that he never comes out alive. So that's what this particular person, who was a former police officer involved in forming relationships with gangs, that's what he was telling other people.
Wow. Okay. I'm starting to get the picture now. Imagine for a moment that if somebody tells you that there is no corruption, that there's way more corruption than you could ever conceive possible, that there's so much that it would actually take you, I don't know, how long does a medical degree take? Like 7 years or something like that, of hardcore sleep deprivation-based mind control study in order to in order to kind of get the idea and be qualified and knowing what the heck you're talking about so you can actually diagnose disease and what have you? That's how bad the corruption is. There could be freaking an entire Auckland University library full of volumes using the Dewey Decimal System, cataloging and chronicling the massive obscene quantity of scumbaggery in New Zealand. Now, we're about to go to break, Ben. You've got one more thing to say and then we're going to go to break. We've got about a minute or so.
I'll say this. Corruption is so widespread in New Zealand that actually we don't see it as corruption. We have actually institutionalized it so that we think that this is morally acceptable conduct. That's how bad it's become. The Peter Williams, who is one of the police officers I spoke to, he wrote a book called Stone on Duty, and then he says we were so dumbed down to believe that there was no corruption that we created an environment in which corruption could thrive. New Zealand journalists all the time write out the fact that when Transparency International, which is a corruption watchdog, file a report on corruption in New Zealand, they always point out the fact that we get the top figure as being the least corrupt country in the world. What they don't report, and this is actual fact, the only reason why we have that ranking is that when those forms come into New Zealand, we don't fill them in, so we send them back to the body with no comments, and so we get a perfect zero. That's the only reason why we get such a great scoring.
It's because we're so corrupt that we don't fill out how much corruption that we've got, because the people who are supposed to be exposing corruption in New Zealand are corrupt.
Exactly, and they're the ones that write the report.
Yeah,
it's the best way. It's the best way. If you have done something wrong and you want to make sure it's covered up, the best way to do it is make sure that you're in control of the corruption investigation.
Yeah,
and this is what Stone on Duty makes the point is that. You know, he caught this particular detective on tape saying, look, Peter, you've got to leave it alone, because you've got to understand that the police complaints authority is set up there for one purpose, and that's to whitewash it to make sure that no mud sticks on us. So this is the body that's meant to protect New Zealanders, but the reality is all the police officers in the ranks know that this is there for one reason, and it's to protect their ass. We don't even have an internal – we're the only Western country in the world that doesn't have an internal affairs. Can you believe that?
I can, and I think that's why – the country is the way it is. Ben Vidgen is my very special guest, and we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Bear in mind, this is a listener-supported broadcast, so if you are capable of supporting the fight to get real information and expose the scumbaggery out there by different voices from all over the world, regardless of what media tell them that they're not credible and shouldn't be listened to and what have you, then go to the VinnieEastwoodShow.com and donate today. Or preferably start up a monthly automatic payment with that little Kiwi Bank or the PayPal. PayPal takes a percentage every time, but the Kiwi Bank doesn't. So automatic payments, it keeps all my rent and internet and stuff paid so that I can spend, you know, the 14, 16, sometimes 18-hour days exposing scumbaggery and helping people's voices be heard. We'll be right back.
Machine serving fiends. I've been in the game for 10 years making rap tunes. Ever since honeys was wearing Sassoon. Now it's 95 and they clock me and watch me diamond shining, looking like a Rob Liberace. It's all good, from Diego to the Bay. Your city is the bomb if your city making pay. Throw up a finger if you feel the same way. Straight putting it down for California, yeah.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest is Ben Vigen from Postman Productions, and we're discussing New Zealand corruption and scumbaggery. And, you know, there's actually one of the largest fields of study in this country. It's kind of like the Great South Basin of scumbaggery. We're trying to tap that puppy right here, you know.
The example that you could use New Zealand to as an analogy so that your American listeners might appreciate it is that what we have done, as is the case in all throughout history, is that we have allowed a small elite to gain too much control. And once they have had that control, their illegal conduct or their immoral conduct has been institutionalized, it has been legalized, it has actually been turned around so that it is a moral conduct. We think it's a good thing to send young men to die in wars. And the end result is that we have actually institutionalized the corruption. Because we let those guys get in to begin with, they've made the abnormal and the deviant behavior into being the accepted status quo behavior.
It's moral decay, more or less, isn't it?
Pretty much all. I mean, New Zealand is a country that, when you drive through every single rural town, you will find in every single town statues up on schools, in the middle of the squares, wherever prominent positions of soldiers or clerks with the names of each individual person that went and fought for not just World War II, World War I, the Boer War. In fact, New Zealand population has more soldiers that have died in foreign fields than any country in the Western Hemisphere. And every single one of those soldiers should be a reminder to us of what we're doing and why we're doing it and why patriotism is not something that you just laugh at. It's not something we stick a sports short with a corporate label on or with a label that says made in China, that it's a little bit deeper than that. Unfortunately, while we have all these great monuments and all these plaques that, when you read them and you take the time to stop and read them, are very sombering, most people just go past them because they've actually been conditioned to completely forget about them except for that one day of the year when we roll out the TV cameras and the trumpets and the old guys and the medals, and we turn it into a patriotizing, we turn it into the Hunger Games. We celebrate mass genocide, and we don't really look at what the bigger picture was. How many scientists that were not born, how many teachers that did not get to teach your classes. We've taken the best and brightest of action for over 150 years and we've murdered them.
Yeah, I think that's right. What do you say to a statue of a soldier? I think in Australia this just recently happened. There was a plaque for the unknown soldier and it says, "Only God knows his name." And just recently, they had to scratch "Only God Knows His Name" because it was deemed offensive.
It's this issue of making the trivial important while we actually overlook the bigger issues. And it goes on and on and on. I'm not a particularly, I don't believe in organized religion. I don't have a problem with it saying God because it was meant at that time with intention of that historic. So to change it is actually rewriting history. And that I find offensive.
Exactly. And it occurs to me that we're moving towards a global society that will have legalized pedophilia, Satanism crossed with New Age solipsism will be the world's religion, and power will only be held by a few wealthy banking families who have microchipped everybody, and they microchip themselves as well, but with a special imprint. So if it ever gets read by anybody, it says you have to leave this person alone. But he's got a dead body in the trunk, and he's got children, and he's got children bound and gagged in the back seats of his car. No. He's got the special chip. He's a banker. He can get away with it. Nobody else can. Right. That's kind of the society that I see being set up, and I see in order to do that, though, you need to socially engineer every single element of what makes a man and what makes a woman. And have you noticed that since the rise of feminism in the 1970s, that the roles of men and women are actually starting to grow, go askew, almost unnaturally so. We have an enormous propensity for divorce, single parents and things like that. I'm not bashing single parents. I'm just saying that what happens is every single time where you don't have that balance, family relationship, that family unit, that loyalty, that blood tie, and what have you, you often will experience some social negative ramifications of that. I think the statistics prove this as well. Young boys who do not have a father for all or most of their life will at some point very likely obtain a criminal conviction, something like seven times more likely than the average child who's grown up in a stable family household. And so you get the children...
I'm just going to stop you there because you're throwing four or five of an ideas, and I'd like to, because they're all relevant things, I'd like to comment on them, and then we can hopefully carry back to that vein. The first thing is to talk about this whole issue of making pedophilia acceptable. Well, I think that, again, it can be provable in the sense of if you look at someone like Miley Cyrus, you look at her 3 years ago, the public image that she was portraying, which was a very innocent young schoolgirl, and she developed a following. And bang, overnight, she suddenly turned into this person that's, you know, doing very explicit stuff. That's a good example of grooming for you right there. We then have the whole issue of internet porn. Now, the reality is, and I've just been talking about this with my partner, you know, I've spent many parts, portions of my life as a single male. Guess what? Male, internet, you do the math. But at the same time, what I've also turned around and done, willingly or unwillingly, every time I turn around and look at big jugs or whatever, what I've actually done is I've left a profile footprint so that if, at any stage, if the state can't get me on all other bits and pieces, they can go to my Google traffic and they can find out all the things that are inside my head and say, if you don't turn around and shut up, we'll use this to embarrass you or to discredit you. So the whole issue of internet porn is actually, it's not just a grooming tool, it's a blackmail tool. Then you get into the whole issue of feminism. Now, this is where I'm on the trickiest piece of thin ice ever. But to a certain degree, I agree with you, Vinny, in the sense of, I was speaking to a friend of mine recently, turned around and said, we've created an environment where, you know, it's not just that, hey, women can go out to work, which I'm perfectly okay with, but it's a case of, I can't go out, I can't stay at home, and look, they won't actually let me look after my own kids. So effectively what they've actually, and for, you know, because if he does, the risk that he is of having SIPs get involved, or the children go and report something, to, you know, whether they've had a bad mood with dad or the neighbors piss off, it's so easy for a male figure to get in trouble, and they will immediately sign. Generally, with the female side. So for him to stay at home, it's not that easy. So you've got two parents that have both been sent out of the house, so there is no parental guidance or hand for the kids to have. So they're getting dysfunctionalized. All the power has been taken away from the parents and put in the hands of the state. Then you get into the whole issue of one law for you and one law for other. In other words, the banker that gets, you know, let off because he's got a body in the bank. Well, the terminology that we have, it's called privilege. It's based from aristocracy or feudal days. And literally the Latin translation means, from according to Terry Pratchett, is of private law. In other words, law for the privileged or the private. The difference is, in feudal times, they also had the concept of what they call nobile obligese, or the obligation of nobility. What we're now having is a feudal system which is entirely privileged, but with no sense of obligation for the people that they're under their care. So this is a pyramid where we're meant to place all our power into their hands, but we can get we will not be looked after. The social contract has been blown up so that only Thug the Barbarian gets all the gold and all the women, and we get to basically be a serfs. That's, you know, fine, and that's what they're doing to us at a state level, base level, and they're also doing it at the family base level. And it's about taking away power from us at all levels.
Yeah, you take away your power internally, externally, and holistically. So eventually to the point, you don't even believe that it's even possible to have power. Yeah. And I think this is actually one of the greatest parts of the agenda at all is learned helplessness.
Yeah.
When people feel that they're helpless, they stop trying to help. Okay, and that's exactly how the corruption and the scumbaggery and it continues and gets worse, because people don't think they can actually do anything about it, so therefore they don't do anything about it, and so therefore nothing changes. I mean, isn't that brilliant?
That's correct. it's completely correct. And this is, you know, the thing is, you know, it's not about being a martyr. It's not about that I've got some superhero complex. It's the reality is I recognize that if I don't actually stand up and act, then it's, you know, and I'll hopefully there's some other people that will take my role model or already doing it. But if they don't, I can see what the consequences are, and that scares me. So my position isn't because I'm some superhero. I come from a position of I can full sight, I can see what's happening, and I don't want that. And you know, and also I was lucky. You know, my grandfather, Major Robinson Cox, was a man that taught me about his experiences in war, and he taught me what it was like to be a citizen and how you had to make sure that you looked after your fellow brothers and sisters. He taught me that patriotism isn't some quaint idea that you just have a little bit of a chuckle with, but it's actually important for this, for the glue of your society. Well, and that for that I thank him every day.
But it's because it's a contract that can be enforced and written in blood. Okay, and I think that that's what happens when you have a belief that is about more than just yourself. And that belief has to be corrupted. It has to be about selfishness and a lack of caring for others that needs to be instilled in society before those who are completely selfish and really, really run the show corruptly, mind you. That's the only way that their society can flourish. And I think what's happened now is we've come up with a system, or rather we didn't, the elite did. They came up with a system where it's so unlikely that you will wind up even seeing their scumbaggery for what it is, let alone exposing it, and so it only gets stronger and more powerful. And the real problem I find here is with the technology element, because the elite are really, really into their technology, mass surveillance and what have you.
And that's where I go back to a guy like Andrew Maguire, because really when you want what he's done, he's done the ultimate strategy for guerrilla war. If your opponent is a high-tech fixed army, you become a low-tech mobile army. And that's what he's done. And he has created an army of information. And this is, you know, what I'm doing in about a week's time. I actually leave Otago and I'm going to be doing a very interesting thing where I'm going to be hitchhiking all around New Zealand, which is, you know, this is a coastline that's greater than Australia. I'm going to be hitchhiking all around New Zealand. And my mission is to go out and find people that are doing incredibly positive things. I've given up asking my government for help. Because they're not. The only people that are going to help you is help yourself. So go out and find those people. Whether it's, if your thing is free energy, go and find the person that's doing amazing things with electric cars, solar power, whatever. If your thing is sustainable seeds, go out and do that. And this is what I'm doing, is I'm finding the people that, and this is what I learned from Andrew again, one good person that is mobilized, that is passionate, that has the courage of convictions, is better than 1,000 sleeping dwarfs. And this is what I'm seeing. I'm going out to find those giants because they are out there.
What you just said reminds me of a line from Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, with Kevin Costner. He said, "I've seen knights shaking in their armor at the first sign of battle, and I have seen an unarmed squire pull a spear from his own body to defend a dying horse. One free man defending his home is more powerful than 10 hired soldiers." The Crusades taught me that.
Exactly. And this is the same situation, is that what I experience and what I know, because, you know, when I went to my university degree, I've probably spent more than 5 years studying terrorism from 1960s to September 11th. You know, this is what I was doing back in the 90s. Terrorism work is very simple. These guys are the terrorists, and their motivation is based in fear, and they fear you more than we fear them. And if you know that, it is not that hard. You can be standing there with no guns, no backup, no police. You know, you're one single journalist. And at the end of the day, I have seen this time and time again, and this is why I'm still alive. I have made the mean in the dark, their hearts quake, and simply because of the fact I'm the one thing that they cannot fathom. And I drag them into the light. I expose them. I bring that action out, and that's what they are afraid of. And they run miles. And you know, sometimes be realistic. Sometimes you do get actually taken out, and that's the price that you pay. But the reality is, if I'm it, and then suddenly there's two people doing it, and then suddenly there's four people doing it, and you know, guess what? They're going to fold pretty damn quick.
Well, let's hope it works that way, because I've got this concern as well that if one person has a great effect, they tend to target that one individual. If a group of people start having an effect and it's underneath a leader, they'll target that leader. My perspective on this is, let's say with my radio show, for example, I've got the most widely listened to alternative radio show in New Zealand at the moment, and I don't want that sole responsibility. What I'd love to do is actually help to foster and garner other people so that they don't need me anymore. They do their own radio shows and what have you, and it makes me obsolete. What if... And I had this theory the other day. If you got 10 million listeners, all of a sudden you have to become corrupted. You have to start playing ball, otherwise they will kill you. All right, because you've got that much massive influence. Can I finish?
Yeah,
sure. So my philosophy is: what if I got 1 million listeners for myself, and then taught 10 other people to get 1 million listeners for themselves? We'd still have the same effect at exposing scumbaggery without them even getting onto their radar.
I agree with you, with the exception of that I'm more than happy to be on their radar. Number one is I'm not the only person doing my line. It may seem that way at times, but the reality is, I do my job. I don't claim to be the big super cop. I'm a small town journalist, and I have a small patch, which is the South Island. That's my beat, and I do it very well, and I do it very passionately. It's me. There's you. There's guys like Nicky Hager. There are citizens journalists popping up. And again, this is what Andrew Maguana has taught. He's one person. He's a figurehead. But he's created an organization that is more than the sum of one part. And this is what you're trying to do. You're creating something that doesn't matter, they chop your head off because there's another 10 people ready to spring up behind you. And that's how it is. You look at guys like Martin Luther King and Gandhi. They didn't get rid of these guys because they were just slightly annoying them. They got rid of them because their methodologies and tactics worked and scared the bejesus out of it. The answer is right in front of us. All we're going to do is go back to history book, find out where they actually upset the apple cart, and utilize those tactics and strategies because they work.
That's actually exactly right, isn't it? You can use the tactic of your enemy against them, just like you can use their own weapons against them. Let's say they created the internet to surveil and enslave everybody. Well, we're now using it to expose and free everybody. You see what I'm saying?
I do. My favorite martial arts, and put this context, I'm not a martial artist. I have my girlfriend can beat me in an arm wrestle. I'm not a martial artist, but the one that I do like is that martial arts of Aikido, and it's a very simple principle. Is it takes your opponent's attacking force, and the bigger that opponent is, the better, and it utilizes that force on a fulcrum basis and turns it against itself. So, in other words, you use your opponent's own force to undermine them. And this is again, a strategy and a philosophy which I practice in my life every day.
In fact, somebody came up to me the other day and... asked me, Vinny, what are you going to do when they come after you? And I go, well, I hope that they do, actually, because at the moment, by comparison to being tortured, exposed to sleep deprivation and what have you, I've got a whole lot to lose, so I'm kind of afraid. I hope that they do something to me like that. I hope that they reduce me to a point where I have absolutely nothing to lose, because that's when I'll find out how truly powerful I actually am.
Well, this is the point with me, Vinny. My mum has Alzheimer's, so she's not long for this world. I don't have kids. I don't have a debt. I've got nothing to lose. There is.
They got nothing to threaten you with.
Exactly. What can they do to me? You can't take anything. I'm the most dangerous guy in the world from that viewpoint. And the reality is, again, is I'm not a martyr. I'm not a hero. Look, I'm a little guy. I stand 5'7". I'm balding on top of my head. I've got reasonably good swimming and running skills, but I'm no Brad Pitt. I just really believe and love my country. And if we don't stand up for it, we lose it all. And it's not just I love my country. And it's not just that I love you and my nation and the people on this planet. There are too many species that we cohabitate and exist upon, and we owe it to them. And if one guy that doesn't have any wife, family, or kids can't turn around and stand up against them, then we are a sad bunch of human beings.
Yeah, patriotism is not a love for one's government. It's a love for one's land and one's people. And
it's a love for one's planet. There is no other planet. Whatever we might think about space or whatever, we mess this up. There is no second game. And science for messing it up. Occasionally from time to time, I actually go and I take up photo and I look at planet Earth from outer space, and every time I do it, it just fills me with so much emotion, and I just think we're so privileged, and people look for magic. It's right in front of us. All we've got to do is brace it. We've got to believe in it, and sometimes it hurts, but this is the difference between a tough guy and a hard guy. A hard guy wants to wrap himself in an arm and go, yeah bro, yeah, I'm a hard man. Well, a tough guy actually accepts that sometimes you hurt, and he lives through the hurt, and he keeps marching forward. And just one small thing, and I'm going to make a little bit of a plug. My partner out there, her thing is she is very much into marine life, and she's trying to do her best for the whales of New Zealand. I mean, that's her thing. I do the land. She does the sea. Her thing is the Jonah Project, which is so if you're out there and you want to donate a couple of dollars, can I recommend that you chuck a couple of ways towards Vinnie at Gorilla Media, but can you also chuck a couple to Jonah, because don't just help out your fellow man, help out your fellow species, because we're all in this together. We all hang together, or we all swing together.
And I also wanted to add people on encouragement on that basis too, is that sometimes donating can make the exact difference in the life of an activist, somebody being given that exact amount of money when they need it. Oh. Other times, instead of donating, if you were to spend, let's say you wanted to donate $100 or something and you earn $25 an hour, what if you devoted 4 hours of your time to activism? What if you got out there with a placard and a camera and what have you and turned it into a YouTube video? It actually has a profound effect. So
you don't even have to just protest. No one's asking everyone to be frontline troops. If your thing, you're into gardening, we'll get involved in a community garden project. If your thing is the environment, we'll go out and help clean rivers. If everybody got up and did a tiny little bit, this planet would be in such a great position. And that's all we're asking. We're not asking you to give up your entire life. We're just asking you to do something for your planet, because you owe it to your planet. This is your mother.
Well, yeah, you have to. And what's interesting is that if you're doing it and people see you doing it, they start to be encouraged to do it as well without you even needing to say anything.
And there's another thing too which you can do, because, this is another thing, I'd like to plant a little seed here. We've been having quite a bit of luck with different projects that we've been doing down here, of basically utilising arts to get people who are not necessarily involved in politics to come involved and get a bit of interest. Arts are a very powerful tool. And one of the main things which I've encouraged in a set of place, which is working very well, is that I will create events which are music orientated. They're not political, they're not billed as political, they're just there for music. And I'll bring good bands into people, and I have people who are into the music and not political coming along, and all I do is that each of each set, as I allow a person that has something worthwhile to say to come up and speak to the audience for 5 minutes, and that, you wouldn't believe how powerful that is. So even if you don't know what to say, but your thing is you know how to pick up a guitar, get with your friends, organise something like that so that you can entertain people, get them a sense of community and glue together, and all you're doing is in that whole entertainment and the whole enjoyment, you're giving them 5 minutes of something to think about, and it's a lot more powerful than sitting there on a platform and speaking people or talking down to people for 40 minutes and then wondering why they're bored and why you've only got 40 people in the octagon that particular day.
You're completely correct, and you have to make exposing scumbaggery fun.
Hell yes, rule the Muppets. I mean, I do this on my show, which is it's called The Postman Show. It's on ORFM 105.4 FM, which if you Google it, there's a website, I can't remember off the top of my head, but there's a live link if you want to listen into it. But what I do in my show, besides from bringing in people that have got really interesting, like yourself, I mean, you'll be on my show very shortly. In fact, we'll rebroadcast the show onto my show. We've got Andrew Maguana, we've got Bill Morris, who's a musician, but he's also come back from the US, and we're going to talk about history and geology. What I do, apart from bringing on board really strong guests, is I mix it up with locally based music, which does three things. First of all, stabilizes me and allows me to just chill out a wee bit and realize that, it's not all about saving the world. Sometimes you're allowed to actually enjoy yourself. Number two is I make a forum to say what I'm saying that is actually palatable to people out there, so that they can digest it in a way that, because we're not all people that sit down and read and digest this stuff 24/7. Some of us can just take in small dosages. The third thing is I provide an opportunity to help promote what my local artists are doing And in doing so, I help them make their careers and their jobs real. And I take a lot of joy out of that. And in doing so, I'm building my own alliance.
It's just like the analogy that I like to use is the lion in the long grass. There's an old story that there was a pygmy in the long grass and a lion was after him, and he got separated from his tribe and he didn't know exactly how to find them. So he stuck a flag up, and what happens is at the exact same time that the predator can suddenly know where you are and starts moving towards you, your allies also suddenly see where you are and come to help you.
Exactly. And this is the thing why, some people will say to me, they go, oh, you know, Ben, you know, things you're saying, you really need to protect yourself and be more careful and don't do that. And I go, look, I'm standing right out in the middle. Anyone makes a move towards me, then people will see it and they will come to my aid. And guess what? You know, Vinny, they actually have. And you know, sometimes what really blows me away, and this is the bit that, you know, I sit there and I just roll my head. You know, I've had cases where I've basically staked out people, and for want of a better word, the stakeouts have gone terribly wrong, and I've exposed myself, and I've started to think, oh my God, you know, I really got my neck out on the chopping block. And then lo and behold, I suddenly find that there's actually, when that's all going on, I suddenly find that there are vehicles parked outside my house, their lights are on, they're smoking cigarettes, they're playing their music, and you know what, they're not there to surveil me, they're there to make sure that anybody out there is clear that this guy is actually protected and stay away. And I mean, when I mean vehicles, I mean not out there for 15 minutes. I mean from coming home at 7 o'clock and find the same vehicle out there at 3 a.m. in the morning with the same guy in the vehicle doing the same thing, smoking cigarettes, listening to music. I don't know what, and I've had this more than once, I don't know why or who. I don't care, but I know that I do have friends out there because there are people out there who do believe in me.
And because you put yourself in a central platform and position and what have you, again, some people do come after you, and it's not just like, you know, the government or corrupt evil ones and what have you that go after you. In fact, I've never actually had any direct contact with those kind of people whatsoever. What it is you know, the Lord of the Rings, how they have troll armies? There is a troll army out there, bro. I'm telling you, they love Facebook. They love YouTube comment sections. If you want to be out in public exposing scumbaggery, there is one thing you need to learn about social media platforms before you really start doing it, and that is how to block people, okay? Yeah. Don't try and argue with them a lot of the case, because all you do is wind up wasting hours and getting yourself frustrated and annoyed with people who are too freaking stupid. Just block and move on.
I do something a little bit different. I don't mind when someone comes onto my site and has a point of difference to me, because I don't claim to know everything. I have a simple rule, however, which is, number one, is that they must conduct themselves in a polite manner. The moment that they lose manners for me or anybody else on that site, block. Number two is they must also basically stay on subject, and they go off subject, block. Number three is that, you know, if they turn around and they start to dominate the conversation, and, you know, I'll give them a gentle reminder, and if they continue to basically turn, you know, I don't have 30 minutes to answer every question, but if they continue, then I'll go block. The other thing too is it's not just about the blocking. You need to actually vet your friends, and there's a number of tricks that spammers, and they come in many shapes and sizes, will do, but you need to make sure that anybody that wants to join your friend, you really need to check their profiles carefully, and these trolls are getting pretty sophisticated, but, you know, basic things like, you know, they say they're from England and you notice that all their friends are actually from Jamaica. Something's not ringing true. Block. If you turn around and you discover that their profile was only set up a day ago, block. If you suddenly discover that they've got all these friends and 90% of them are your friends as well, block. That, and tying in with that, is one of the things which I've only really just instigated, is that my site's fairly openly publicly, except for what I've done now is, people can see the wall, but all things like who my friends are and what movies they like and things like that, I've actually put them on a private setting, because what I also find is that these guys will come in and they will seek out information about you and what they can do. They're looking for weak points. So, you know, it's not just blocking. Learn to maintain and monitor your settings. Recently, you know, the game with the Spandidos thing is that, you know, this is what I've already encountered, was that I get guys coming onto my site and looking at me and making comments about my Bandita comments. And when I go look at the sites, they're all full of Harley Davidsons and, you know, Sons of Anarchy. I like Sons of Anarchy. So, gee, I wonder who they're affiliated with. Not the first time I had. I had one case where I basically turned around, this guy wanted to friend me. And when I looked at his profile, I went, I don't know anybody from Saudi Arabia. And when I looked at his profile again,
I went, I certainly don't know anyone that works at the military hospital and his specialty is toxicology. So I looked at his photographs, and there was a whole bunch of Korans and AK-47s, and you know, which is the sort of things when you think about it are a bit funny. You don't really expect terrorists to actually kind of put that on their own profiles. But the one that really blew me away was one of his mutual friends that I found from looking at his mutual friends had integrated himself into my network, actually had a picture of him standing, of this guy, a photo taken inside the security compound of a US Marine soldier standing in front of Air Force One. As soon as I found that out, I rang Alistair Thompson, who runs Scoop Media, another guy, one of us out there that does a fantastic job, huge network, followed by every single journalist in this country and respected by every single politician in this country, another Andrew Maguana. He's looked for the common ground. He hasn't sought to see enemies. He's looked for common ground. But I rang Alistair and said, look, you know, Alistair, this is what's going on. I just want you to be aware of it. So at any stage someone starts throwing accusations at me that I'm tied up with Al-Qaeda or Islam, you can say, well, actually, no, before this event, he came to me and you know, this is what occurred. So, you know, it's not just that trolls will try and stall you. They will try and discredit you by any means, and you have to be vigilant to it, but not paranoid.
Yeah, vigilant.
Vigilance, that's the one.
Yeah, vigilance, yeah. It's vigilance, but except your name's vigilant.
And vigilance we trust.
Yeah, and I'm invincible.
Oh. I like that. I can see Nestrix and Obix comics coming. I'm going to go away and think about that one because there's some great little... The Vincinator.
Vinny for Vendetta.
Yeah. Well, you know, speaking of which, and I know I'm going to prick a few, you know, opinions out there, I'm not personally a big fan of Anonymous, and one of the reasons why is that, again, when we had this incident with this situation with the Air Force One and the Al-Qaeda thing, it was at that during that time that Alistair and I were talking on the same conversation. It was about 5 o'clock in the morning. The chairman said, "Have you looked at what's happening with Boston?" I said, "What's happening with Boston?" And he, you know, put me to some links, and it had all these basically armored personnel and riot police and so on that were just streaming in row after row, railway carriages into Boston. Now, this was about 2 weeks before the Occupy movement actually got mainstream media attention global wide. And my point is, have you ever heard of a riot situation where the riot police turn up before the rioters? And this is my problem, is that when we did Occupy, while it was a really good networking exercise, and I'm happy with that, what it also did was it gave the powers that be via Facebook name, rank, and serial number of every possible agitator. And everybody that gathered to it got photographed, they got surveillance, their names recorded. In some ways, Anonymous, which was part of that, basically put us on the block. And as far as like taking orders from some guy who hasn't got a mask and I don't know who is, no, I'm not going to do that. You know, at the end of the day, I don't expect people to believe or follow what I'm doing, but at least I always stand up and they can see my face and they will know what my truth is and by what my version of the truth, by what my authority is, and that is by the willingness for me to actually stand up and be there. In my first book, you know, I turned around, I explored all my own past, and I didn't need to do that. I was a bit of a delinquent when I was younger. I never got caught. I was actually pretty good. I was a pretty good damn, you know, criminal in my day. I did it because I wanted to show my readers that while I don't necessarily claim to have all the answers, that they could at least trust me that I would report as honestly and as accurately what I was saying from that perspective. Because, you know, I shared this, and I didn't need to, but I gave it to the readers so they would know who I was. And that doesn't go with this whole masking. I'm not behind this mask thing.
I do agree with you on that perspective, but again, it comes down to personal choice. Some people don't want their identities out there, and you know, let's face facts here. Putting your identity out there does indeed put you at risk. Let's not deny that. But at the same time, I disagree.
I disagree with Vinny. This is look. I've been doing what I've been doing for 25 years. In my early days, you know, I've been shot at. I've had my car, my friend's car blown up. I've had break-ins, I've been threatened with death threats. You know, what I've discovered is the more I'm out there, the more that my profile is out there, the safer I am. And as I pointed out, because of who I am and what I've been doing, I'm not saying I'm invincible, you know, I'm only 5'7", for God's sake, but that position of being in public makes me a very, you know, they can't shoot me without revealing the fact that I just fired the gun. If I turn around, I'm in the dark, I'm hiding in the bushes, it's a lot easier to cut my throat.
Yeah, I was actually about to say that before you cut me off. And the other element here is bravery, okay, is that fortune favors the bold. If you be bold, you'll find out that you wind up having a lot of very fortunate coincidence happening to you. Has this happened to you?
It's I believe in the law of synchronicity, and I do really believe in it. But it's more than that. You know, is if you are bold and if you are true to thyself, then what happens is, you know, people aren't idiots. They recognize, you know, you can fool a person once, but you can't fool them twice. And, well, some of them you can, actually. But eventually, the truth, you know, people recognize what you are. If you keep doing what you're doing time and time and time again, what I find is that suddenly people that do have influences or have abilities to help me will suddenly kind of come along. And you know, sometimes because of their positions, they do it very, very subtly. But, you know, if you're bold and you're out there, people admire that and they respect it. And you will, even your enemies respect it, you know. And that's, at the end of the day, why I'm still standing. And it's I mean, synchronicity does come into it, but at the end of the day, I'm standing here because of all the support of people behind me. And I wouldn't have got that if I sort of turned around and very meekly, occasionally stuck my head up over the parrot. It's all or nothing, really.
Yeah, in fact, I'm starting to really think about this, like the whole anonymous setting and people always pseudonyms and fake names and things like that on Facebook. It's kind of irritating because I'm not trying to hide my identity or anything.
Well, it's not. It's look at 1984. It's right there for you. V for Vendetta was simply Orson Welles' 1984 remade all over. What did they do? The Big Brother turns around and creates a pseudo terrorist organization as an excuse to turn around and subvert people. This is an old trick. You create the problem, you identify the problem, and then so that you can cure the problem, people say, give me all your power, please, so that you can shut it down. Yeah, this is again Andrew Maguana. When I was turning around talking to him, like one of the things he's best known for is the issue of piracy in Somalia. And I say to him, like, you know, Andrew, you know, how do you go about doing this? He says, well, first of all, when I'm dealing with these people, I realise that the person that carries the AK-47, he doesn't own that AK-47. He didn't buy that AK-47. And then I turn around and look at the fisherman on the boat or the freighter, and it's the same situation. That man doesn't own that freighter. He didn't own it. And inevitably, what you actually find is that you find that the very people that bought, the very people that fished out the waters in Somalia, that dumped toxic waste into Somalia, own the boats, are the same people that then turned around and bought the guns, which they sold to the pirates, which then created a piracy issue, which then resulted in the United Nations coming in there and cracking down on these people. And, of course, it just happens to be that there's a lot of oil there. Game, set, match.
You can't make this stuff up.
You can't. Look, one of the things which I just kind of also explain. One of the reasons why I got in contact with Andrew was in my two books, I deal very much with the issue of the arms trafficking and these big airplanes that fly in. If everyone's seen the movie Lord of War, these are the kind of airplanes I'm talking about. Now, one of these things I discovered was that New Zealand is known to be a very clean, green, you know, friendly country that doesn't get involved in dirty, dodgy stuff. We were actually supplying the encrypted radios to the Liberian warlord, Charles Taylor. This was on the Truth and Reconciliation of Liberian Files. That was already mentioned there. I then turned around and I discovered that the yachts, these same planes, were, you know, you could just take their registration number, Google them, and find that they'd been in the newspaper articles. But I could ring the press up here before these planes flew and say, look, this plane's come in and it's an known arms trafficker, and they'll do nothing. But these planes would fly in, and what they were doing was they were here to pick up the yachts that were used for the America's Cup yacht race. This is a huge sporting event, lots of logos, lots of charity money, you know, good for laundry too, by the way. Lots of this stuff going on. Wave flag, isn't it great? We're winning a yacht race. Blah, blah, blah. Well, they'll take these yachts and they would fly them to Valencia where they held the races. Well, the same yachts use the encrypted radios to make sure that each other competitor doesn't know what the other one's doing. But those are the same encrypted radios which we then sell on to the warlords and the pirates that create the problems that the UN then has to come and solve. Now, I told this to Andrew, and Andrew in his online, I think it's called EcoTerror, mentioned, you know, he ran an article of mine. He said, this is Ben Bidgen, he does this, and we've corroborated this information using WikiLeaks, and that there is a New Zealand firm, which I didn't know about this age, called Radiola. They're the recipients of a New Zealand Defence Award, that this company was shipping encrypted radios to the Sudan, where former United Nations and former New Zealand Army officers were then selling those equipments to the very people carrying out the genocide, which then resulted in us calling in the UN to get involved. Now, this was reported, this is WikiLeaks, this was reported in the Washington Post, and you do not get a bigger paper than the Washington Post.
Oh, apart from the New York Times. But
yeah. Files also get sent to, well, exactly, well, also reported in the New York Times, I believe, but it was definitely the Washington Post. But WikiLeaks files also get sent to the New Zealand main New Zealand journalist beforehand. So this was in the Washington Post. These guys were given the exact files. This story has never once
apart from me and apart from my Andrews International Network and Washington Post, has never been reported once in New Zealand. So the very people that are there to solve the problem, you can actually trace back via the money trail to be the cause.
I think that's what you call the dissociated press.
Yeah, the dissociated manufacturing dissent.
In fact, hey, that would be a great organization for us to start up, don't you think, Ben? The dissociated press, staffed entirely by journalists, have been fired for telling the truth.
Well, yeah, we could call it free typos to good homes. I want to just switch back into this positive thing in terms of it's very easy to identify the problems. And all this whole, people get wrapped up in like studying the New World and the Illuminati. I did that when I was 19 years old, and I rapidly concluded that all you're doing is you're going down a rabbit hole, and all you're going to do is unearth more problems and more conspiracy. You know, these kind of conspiracies are easy to spot because they leave a blood trail that's about 1,000 miles long. You just follow the smoke and the carnage. That's how easy these guys are. It's a deliberate red herring. The real answer is to go out and find people that are solution-based. And this is I come from a past of reporting on the problems, and I still will do it because it's part of who I am, and it is part important. But these days, I'm more fixated in finding people that are doing solutions. And whether it's said, this is the person that's doing a community garden, whether this is the person that's doing electric cars, whether this is the person that's finding a way to look after old people, I don't care. It's the people that are actually saying, look, I'm not going to ask the government for any help. It's the people that say, I'm going to stand up on my own two feet, and I'm going to reach into my own power, and that's what's going to be my energy source. I don't need permission to do this. I don't need to belong to an organization to do this. All I need to do is do it myself and find like-minded, free spirits, free thinkers, and I'll come back to that in a point, that will walk alongside me. Not with me, but alongside me. And the free thinker is the person that can walk into a problem, and instead of saying, I'm going to do my analysis based on what my assumptions are and what I'm told, a free thinker is someone that says, I'm going to walk in here and I'm going to try my best methodology to approach this in a logical way, to quantify and reinforce the facts, and I'm going to let those facts speak for themselves. So at the end of the day, what comes up is not about what I perceive or what I think. It's simply working for the process, and the answer inevitably unfolds itself. And free thinkers are the most powerful people on this planet, and they're often the people that get laughed at the most.
Yeah, and usually by people who can't think. And that's one of my points about university now, is they don't teach critical thinking anymore. They teach students how to be critical of people who can still think despite going to university.
Well, they do, and it's kind of interesting because before I was doing my show on ORFM, I did a show at the local university down here. This is meant to be a student radio station, and I had a huge following. I had musicians coming every week bringing me music. I had guests liking my show from all around. Basically, the feedback was extremely strong. Yet, in the end, they cancelled the show, and they wouldn't give me a reason. Like, I had been bringing in, former members of the Central Intelligence Agency. I had A-plus quality guests coming in the show, as I do work towards. What I traced back to in the end was the political science department were not happy with the fact that I was suggesting fringe ideas that people at least consider them. Not necessarily believe in them, but consider all of the arguments. So what they did was they cancelled my show. They filled it with a show on a very similar format, but that it did not at any stage preach anything other than the status quo, and they call that education. I have 2 degrees. I know what education is. I know what academic methodology is. I very rarely see it practiced in modern universities.
Yeah, I have a 2 degrees mobile. That's how qualified I am.
you have a QBE, Benny.
What the hell is that? No, that's what is that?
Qualification based on experience.
Okay, because I thought I just graduated from the University of Getting Shit Done. It's in Germany.
that's the one, mate. And the thing is, I guess one of the little things I like to plant with people. Not everybody has a university degree. In fact, some people have a university degree and they don't approach methodology. People go on the internet and they're curious, they're intelligent people, and they reach out and they try and find information. I'm all behind that. What I do ask people to do is, anything I've said today, whether you believe it or you don't believe it, do me one favor. Go out and find 3 separate sources that will, if you think it's true, find 3 separate sources that will validate it. And once you find those 3 sources, look at them. Have a real hard look at these people and say, the people that are validating it, did they have documented evidence? Is their name out in public? You know, it's not just the quantity of the vindication, you've got to look at the quality. And this is all you need to do. If you want to do research on it online and on the internet, you know, go ahead, be curious, dig where you can, but always verify your information. And once you've verified your information, make sure that your sources that are verifying it, that they stand up. And this in the long run will save you from going down a lot of rabbit holes and make you look stupid. If you are willing to take your time and be methodical about it, the answers will come, but you don't need to learn it all, and you don't need to have a degree to do it. You've just got to do it carefully, like you'll do any job, whether it's being a mechanic, a gardener. You know, just a little bit of care and diligence is what I'm asking of people out there.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. The problem is, though, my mechanical skills are pretty lax when it comes to doing research, reading stuff. I kind of actually going to university for 2 years put me off reading, because every single thing that they ever told me to read was full of convoluted language that didn't make any sense, wasn't rational, wasn't logical, and was basically boring.
That's again part of the whole, you know, process, because at the end of the day, you know, as a writer, and I'm actually dyslexic, so that's quite a small milestone. I'm a writer in the first place and have 2 degrees, but the language they put in at your academic is jargonized so that only that club will actually allow to do this. And this is, you know, quite normal. Like when you look at the whole issue of Latin was originally designed so that it was the language spoken so only the priests could turn around and give the blessings. It was a language which was based in law so that only the lawyer could give the legal verdict. Jargon is created to reinforce the laws of the elite. If you actually say something in plain speech, you should be able to say less, more eloquently. Or the way I like to put it is that you can be a prince and lie in the highest of language, yet be a fool and list great wisdom.
Can we ask as well that we as a people admit that we don't know what we're talking about sometimes, and actually have a bit of humility. And I think this is I made this post this morning because I've been arguing with a few atheists here or there on Facebook, and every single one of them is an arrogant douchebag who kind of talks down to you, sort of thing. And I was just like, well, how is that a coincidence? They all define themselves as atheists, and I'm not bagging all atheists, just every single one that I've ever spoken to. Which would number in the tens, maybe, by no means all atheists, but
I think it's a little bit, I'm not going to sing like the atheist. What I'd say is it's a case of don't bite the dogma that feeds you. I see this in terms of where I sit, is that, you know, I'll turn around and I'll look at something like the issue of chemtrails or half, and I do it in a very, what I like to think, a very diligent way, and I find what happens is I have one group of people that I can turn around and tell them anything they want to believe. Like, oh, yeah, harp's great, chemtrails have certainly happened, blah, blah, blah. And they're not really being – they've chosen to believe something, and you can't shake them off it. On the other hand, you'll have people that will turn around and say, no, that's all rubbish, and it doesn't matter what facts. They say, oh, well, that was true, the peer review. So you show them the peer reviews. You know, it's looking at two sides of the same coin. When people get stuck in a dogma and they're not willing to accept the fact that they don't know all the answers and that they really must – always recheck and reconsider their viewpoint, that's what happens. And that's, again, part of the whole divide and conquer process. At the end of the day, none of us know the answers. In your case, Vinny, I mean, you say by yourself that you're not a great reader, but what you are is that you're a seed sower. You plant ideas in people's heads, and so even if someone doesn't necessarily agree with the show, this is why I was like the show, it's you give people something that, A, makes them think. You give them something to go away and educate them a little bit. They have a laugh along the way. What you do is brilliant. You know, you don't need to be saying, this is the truth. And I don't think I've ever heard you say that. You simply say, hey, isn't this an amazing concept? Let's wake our brains up and have a little bit of fun with this and play along with it and see what goes on. And that is amazing. You know, that's brilliant radio.
If you say so.
I do say so.
There's the other element here as well, is when you get given a microphone, sometimes your ego gets running away with you. So that's half of the reason why I self-deprecate a lot of the time in order to prevent that from happening. And I also hope that if in some point in time I start saying, this is the truth, it's absolute fact, and so on and so forth, and I become close-minded and totally critical of everybody and basically morph into some form of Vinnie Eastwood douchebag monster, that all of the people that I've been interviewing and so on and so forth throughout the years, people like yourself and whatnot, will come out and expose me and say, Vinnie, you're now a douchebag, nobody should listen to you. That would be my great hope.
I don't think I personally would ever turn around and do that, even if you did it, simply because I don't see the credit. I don't want to waste my energy tearing people down. I want to build people actually up, and there's much more power to be had in that than you know, tearing things down. I do agree with what you're saying, because, you know, at the end of the day, you know, call it small man syndrome, whatever you have, I've got a very healthy ego. I'm very thankful for the people out there that laugh at me or, for want of a better word, get jealous of me, because they actually act as a self-built humility service. They always make me check in with myself and go, you know, what those guys doing legitimate? I'm thankful for my friends who can take quite happily take the merciful Mickey out of me. Again, they bring me down to the earth. I walk a delicate line in the sense of, I know it's important that I put out a profile, and I even know that the profile to a certain way is a constructed myth. But that's there for a purpose, so that I can do my job. At the end of the day, I flip myself off, I go home with my partner, I have a glass of wine, and I chill out with my friends, and I just get on with life like all the rest of us. You know, the moment that you start thinking that you're more important, and this is the thing, I smashed my neck up about 15 years ago, and sometimes I'm a real jerk, and I'm like, and I forget this. I forget that what I sometimes belittle, well, it may not be important to me, but it's important to those people. And that's another thing that I try, it's a personal thing I'm working on, but it's something I always try and work on, is that I'm not the only one out here, and the moment I really think that is the case, I am the douchebag.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, knowing something is about having that process constantly in review, I think. If you think the exact same thing today that you thought last year, it means you haven't learned anything, which means you have chosen to stop listening, stop looking, stop learning, and then there's very little that way that you can do to improve yourself on that basis. If we are talking about, I don't know, self-worth, okay, which means you can be insulted by somebody who's far less intelligent, far less respectful than myself, far less experienced, and basically that really doesn't know what they're talking about, even far less than I. Those people are become what I've come to term as energy vampires. They literally sap your strength, and there's no gain from it.
Look, we're running kind of close to the. So I'm going to need to probably pull out about 4 minutes. But you know what I point out is, you know, again, Gandhi turned around and said, first, you know, when you stand out of the crowd and you try to socially motivate people, especially if it's against the status quo, first they will ignore you, then they will laugh at you, and then they will fight you, and then you win. And this is what you basically have to turn around and do. And when people turn around and laugh at me, I actually don't recognize that as a win. Because that's the second step. And what I've noticed slowly over the years, I've been doing my bits and pieces, is that, yeah, I've got people that, you know, went to the fighting stage, and now I'm at a stage where my own, even people in my own town, that not even because of what I'm saying, you know, it's because they're going, well, he's got a platform, I want that platform, that should be right. Even those people started to realize the way that I conduct myself, that, you know, sometimes I'm a bit of a dick on a personal aspect in terms of error, but they also recognize that my heart's in the right place, and that I am loyal, and that I do stand up for my town. And, you know, slowly I'm winning these people over, one at a time. Some of them you're never going to win. Some of them I don't want to win over. I take personal satisfaction when I look at the guy that was responsible for sinking $400 million into building a football stadium as a con. I take personal satisfaction that when I walk past him and he's sitting there drinking his cup of coffee and I look at him, he shrivels. And, you know, that's it. You can, man, you got all the big houses, you got all the big girls, you got, but at the end of the day, you can't look at yourself in the mirror because you know that what you've done is wrong. And that's it.
You like creep up behind him while he's having a coffee, just going, boogie, boogie.
I was playing fun with him the other day. He sat down and I just, oh, what the hell? I brought up my camera and I just took a photograph of him. Oh, man. For the next half an hour, that poor man was just like looking over his shoulder and getting all freaked out. And I just didn't do anything. I wasn't going to do anything with the photograph. I knew what his internal fear was like, and I played upon it. I was being a bit naughty, to be honest. But it was just, you know, I get a little bit sick and tired when I see these guys wandering around pretending like they're the most respectable people in town when they've actually done their best to actually sink, you know, this town into a debt cycle and destroy everything that 150 years worth of good people built up. The reality is, it was a test. I wanted to say, think to myself, you know, what, do you go home and look at yourself in the mirror and think I'm a good guy? So I just had a little tease and I got the answer. No, he goes home and he looks at himself and goes, I need more. I need more gyms. I need more this. I need that because I don't like myself. And this is sadly what the whole childness of all of this stuff, that's what it's all based in. And I'll end with the very last point, Vinny. We all are human beings. We all have parts of us that aren't that great. And sometimes we get scared. Don't be scared. You're allowed to make mistakes. All you need to do is say, hey, I made a mistake, and go out there and do your best. Love yourself, people, because you know, there's plenty of people out there who will tear you down. You've got to love yourself, and you've got to be true to yourself.
Yeah, and you've got to have fun as well. A friend of mine once went to a protest outside Parliament on Halloween, and everybody was dressed as zombies. What do we want?
Brains.
When do we want it?
Brains.
You know? There's a lot of power to be had in that sort of stuff. And again, it goes back to the whole issue of art. If you have something that makes people laugh, and I mean, seriously, I mean, you look around what really gets under dictators' skins. Go and Google up Charlie Chaplin's speech about the dictator and find out why Hitler absolutely hated Charlie Chaplin. What that man had to say was visionary. And what I found in my experience is that if I can find a way to make someone look ridiculous at the top, man, it's brilliant because they just flip out. And in doing so, they rip the mask off their face and they show everybody what the real colours are.
There's an old saying, how do you expose a fascist? By making them act like it.
Yep, that's the one.
Ben, that's give us a quick plug for your website and then we've got to go.
My website is www.postmanproductions.org. Do be consistent because, you know, being what I do, you quite often find that the links mysteriously don't come up. So, you know, go back every couple of days because that's what happens. I have a Facebook site, which is open. People can look at what I'm doing and monitor what I'm actually up to on my Facebook site. This is simply Ben, B-E-N, or I'll spell it phonetically for my American friends out there. That's Bravo Echo November. And then it's Vigil, which I'll also spell phonetically for you. That's Victor India Delta Golf Echo November. I say again, Victor India Delta Golf Echo November. Look at my Facebook page. It's got all my daily rants and raves actually up there. And again, I do my radio show Wednesday night, 8:30 New Zealand time. It's on the Otago Access Radio. You can just Google it. It has a link on the top left hand of the screen. There is a live stream. Or what I tend to do is I put the podcast up on my show later on. So, Vinny, once again, thank you very much for having me on the show. And for those people out there listening, in the words of George Clooney, good night and good luck.
All right. And ladies and gentlemen, bear in mind, this is, again, a listener-supported broadcast. It does not exist without your continued support and donation. So please go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com and start off to make a monthly donation today. Thank you, Ben. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening. And we'll see you again sometime.
Exception.